This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Drama of the Gifted Child, The Search for the True Self, completely revised and updated, with a new afterword by the author, written by Alice Miller, translated by Ruth Ward, read by Suzanne Torin. 1. The Drama of the Gifted Child and How We Became Psychotherapists. Experience has taught us that we have only one enduring weapon in our struggle against mental illness, the emotional discovery of the truth about the unique history of our childhood. Is it possible, then, to free ourselves altogether from illusions? History demonstrates that they sneak in everywhere, that every life is full of them, perhaps because the truth often seems unbearable to us. And yet, the truth is so essential that its loss exacts a heavy toll in the form of grave illness. In order to become whole, we must try, in a long process, to discover our own personal truth, a truth that may cause pain before giving us a new sphere of freedom. If we choose instead to content ourselves with intellectual wisdom, we will remain in the sphere of illusion and self-deception. The damage done to us during our childhood cannot be undone, since we cannot change anything in our past. We can, however, change ourselves. We can repair ourselves and gain our lost integrity by choosing to look more closely at the knowledge that is stored inside our bodies and bringing this knowledge closer to our awareness. This path, although certainly not easy, is the only route by which we can at last leave behind the cruel, invisible prison of our childhood. We become free by transforming ourselves from unaware victims of the past into responsible individuals in the present who are aware of our past and are thus able to live with it. Most people do exactly the opposite, without realizing that the past is constantly determining their present actions. They avoid learning anything about their history. They continue to live in their repressed childhood situation, ignoring the fact that it no longer exists. They are continuing to fear and avoid dangers that, although once real, have not been real for a long time. They are driven by unconscious memories and by repressed feelings and needs that determine nearly everything they do or fail to do. The repression of brutal abuse experienced during childhood drives many people to destroy their lives and the lives of others. In an unconscious thirst for revenge, they may engage in acts of violence, burning homes and businesses, and physically attacking other people, using this destruction to hide the truth from themselves and avoid feeling the despair of the tormented child they once were. Such acts are often done in the name of patriotism or religious beliefs. Other people actively continue the torture once inflicted upon them in self-scourging clubs of every sort and in sadomasochistic practices. They think of such activities as liberation. Women who allow their nipples to be pierced in order to hang rings from them can then pose for newspaper photographs, proudly saying that they felt no pain when having it done and that it was even fun for them. One need not doubt the truth of their statements. They had to learn very early in life not to feel pain, and today they would go to any lengths not to feel the pain of the little girl who was once sexually exploited by her father and had to imagine that it was fun for her. Repressed pain may reveal itself more privately, as in a woman sexually exploited as a child who has denied her childhood reality, and in order not to feel the pain, is perpetually fleeing her past with the help of men, alcohol, drugs, or achievement. She needs a constant thrill to keep boredom at bay. Not even one moment of quiet can be permitted, during which the burning loneliness of her childhood experience might be felt, for she fears that feeling more than death. She will continue in her flight unless she learns that the awareness of old feelings is not deadly, but liberating. The repression of childhood pain influences not only the life of an individual, but also the taboos of the whole society. The usual run of biographies illustrates this very clearly. In reading the biographies of famous artists, for example, one gains the impression that their lives began at puberty. Before that, we are told, they had a happy, contented, or untroubled childhood, or one that was full of deprivation, or very stimulating. But what a particular childhood really was like does not seem to interest these biographers, as if the roots of a whole life were not hidden and entwined in its childhood. I should like to illustrate this with a simple example. Henry Moore describes in his memoirs how, as a small boy, he massaged his mother's back with an oil to soothe her rheumatism. Reading this suddenly threw light for me on Moore's sculptures, the great reclining women with the tiny heads. I could now see in them the mother through the small boy's eyes, with the head high above, in diminishing perspective, and the back close before him and enormously enlarged. This interpretation may be irrelevant for many art critics, but for me it demonstrates how strongly a child's experiences may endure in his unconscious, and what possibilities of expression they may awaken in the adult who is free to give them rein. Now, Moore's memory did not concern a traumatic event, and so could survive intact. But every childhood's traumatic experiences remain hidden and locked in darkness, and the key to our understanding of the life that follows is hidden away with them. The Poor Rich Child. I sometimes ask myself whether it will ever be possible for us to grasp the extent of the loneliness and desertion to which we were exposed as children. Here I do not mean to speak primarily of children who were obviously uncared for or totally neglected, and who were always aware of this, or at least grew up with the knowledge that it was so. Apart from these extreme cases, there are large numbers of people who enter therapy in the belief with which they grew up, that their childhood was happy and protected. Quite often I've been faced with people who were praised and admired for their talents and their achievements, who were toilet-trained in the first year of their lives, and who may even, at the age of 1.5 to 5, have capably helped to take care of their younger siblings. According to prevailing attitudes, these people, the pride of their parents, should have had a strong and stable sense of self-assurance. But the case is exactly the opposite. They do well, even excellently, in everything they undertake. They are admired and envied. They are successful whenever they care to be. But behind all this lurks depression, a feeling of emptiness and self-alienation, and a sense that their life has no meaning. These dark feelings will come to the fore as soon as the drug of grandiosity fails, as soon as they are not on top, not definitely the superstar, or whenever they suddenly get the feeling they have failed to live up to some ideal image or have not measured up to some standard. Then they are plagued by anxiety or deep feelings of guilt and shame. What are the reasons for such disturbances in these competent, accomplished people? In the very first interview, they will let the listener know that they have had understanding parents, or at least one such, and if they are aware of having been misunderstood as children, they feel that the fault lay with them and with their inability to express themselves appropriately. They recount their earliest memories without any sympathy for the child they once were. And this is the more striking, as these patients not only have a pronounced introspective ability, but seem to some degree to be able to empathize with other people. Their access to the emotional world of their own childhood, however, is impaired, characterized by a lack of respect, a compulsion to control and manipulate, and a demand for achievement. Very often they show disdain and irony even derision and cynicism for the child they were. In general, there is a complete absence of real emotional understanding or serious appreciation of their own childhood vicissitudes, and no conception of their true needs beyond the desire for achievement. The repression of their real history has been so complete that their illusion of a good childhood can be maintained with ease. As a basis for a description of the psychic climate of these persons, some general assumptions should be made clear. The child has a primary need from the very beginning of her life to be regarded and respected as the person she really is at any given time. When we speak here of the person she really is at any given time, we mean emotions, sensations, and their expression from the first day onward. In an atmosphere of respect and tolerance for her feelings, the child, in the phase of separation, will be able to give up symbiosis with the mother and accomplish the steps toward individuation and autonomy. If they are to furnish these prerequisites for the healthy development of their child, the parents themselves ought to have grown up in such an atmosphere. If they did, they will be able to assure the child the protection and well-being she needs to develop trust. Parents who did not experience this climate as children are themselves deprived. Throughout their lives, they will continue to look for what their own parents could not give them at the appropriate time, the presence of a person who is completely aware of them and takes them seriously. This search, of course, can never fully succeed, since it relates to a situation that belongs irrevocably to the past, namely to the time right after birth and during early childhood. A person with this unsatisfied and unconscious, because repressed, need will nevertheless be compelled to attempt its gratification through substitute means, as long as she ignores her repressed life history. The most efficacious objects for substitute gratification are a parent's own children. The newborn baby or small child is completely dependent on his parents, and since their caring is essential for his existence, he does all he can to avoid losing them. From the very first day onward, he will muster all his resources to this end, like a small plant that turns toward the sun in order to survive. In my work with people in the helping professions, I have often been confronted with a childhood history that seems significant to me. There was a mother who, at the core, was emotionally insecure and who depended for her equilibrium on her child's behaving in a particular way. By mother, I here refer to the person closest to the child during the first years of life. This need not be the biological mother or even a woman. In the course of the past 20 years, many fathers have assumed this mothering function, Mütterlichkeit. This mother was able to hide her insecurity from her child and from everyone else behind a hard, authoritarian, even totalitarian facade. This child had an amazing ability to perceive and respond intuitively, that is, unconsciously, to this need of the mother, or of both parents, for him to take on the role that had unconsciously been assigned to him. This role secured love for the child, that is, his parents' exploitation. He could sense that he was needed, and this need guaranteed him a measure of existential security. This ability is then extended and perfected. Later, these children not only become mothers, confidants, comforters, advisors, supporters of their own mothers, but also take over at least part of the responsibility for their siblings, and eventually develop a special sensitivity to unconscious signals manifesting the needs of others. No wonder they often choose to become psychotherapists later on. Who else, without this previous history, would muster sufficient interest to spend the whole day trying to discover what is happening in other people's unconscious? But the development and perfecting of this sensitivity, which once assisted the child in surviving and now enables the adult to pursue his strange profession, also contained the roots of his emotional disturbance. As long as the therapist is not aware of his repression, it can compel him to use his patients, who depend on him, to meet his unmet needs with substitutes. The Lost World of Feelings. On the basis of my experience, I think that the cause of an emotional disturbance is to be found in the infant's early adaptation. The child's needs for respect, echoing, understanding, sympathy, and mirroring have had to be repressed, with several serious consequences. One such consequence is the person's inability to experience consciously certain feelings of his own, such as jealousy, envy, anger, loneliness, helplessness, or anxiety, either in childhood or later in adulthood. This is all the more tragic in that we are concerned here with lively people who are often capable of deep feelings. It is most noticeable when they describe childhood experiences that were free of pain and fear. They could enjoy their encounters with nature, for example, without hurting the mother or making her feel insecure, reducing her power, or endangering her equilibrium. It is remarkable how these attentive, lively, and sensitive children, who can, for example, remember exactly how they discovered the sunlight in bright grass at the age of 4, at 8 were unable to notice anything, or show any curiosity about their pregnant mother, or were not at all jealous at the birth of a sibling. It is also remarkable how, at the age of 2, such a child could be left alone and be good, while soldiers forced their way into the house and searched it, suffering the terrifying intrusion quietly and without crying. These people have all developed the art of not experiencing feelings, for a child can experience her feelings only when there is somebody there who accepts her fully, understands her, and supports her. If that person is missing, if the child must risk losing the mother's love or the love of her substitute in order to feel, then she will repress her emotions. She cannot even experience them secretly, just for herself. She will fail to experience them at all. But they will nevertheless stay in her body, in her cells, stored up as information that can be triggered by a later event. Throughout their later life, these people will have to deal with situations in which these rudimentary feelings may awaken, but without the original connection ever becoming clear. The connection can be deciphered only when the intense emotions have been experienced in therapy and successfully linked with their original situation. In some new therapy methods, this phenomenon plays an essential role. Take, for example, the feeling of abandonment. Not that of the adult who feels lonely and therefore turns to alcohol or drugs, goes to the movies, visits friends, or makes unnecessary telephone calls in order to bridge the gap somehow. No, I mean the original feeling in the small infant, who had none of these means of distraction, and whose communication, verbal or pre-verbal, did not reach the mother because his mother herself was deprived. For her part, she was dependent on a specific echo from the child that was essential to her, for she herself was a child in search of a person who could be available to her. However paradoxical this may seem, a child is at the mother's disposal. The mother can feel herself the center of attention, for her child's eyes follow her everywhere. A child cannot run away from her as her own mother once did. A child can be brought up so that it becomes what she wants it to be. A child can be made to show respect. She can impose her own feelings on him, see herself mirrored in his love and admiration, and feel strong in his presence. But when he becomes too much, she can abandon that child to a stranger or to solitary confinement in another room. When a woman has had to repress all these needs in relation to her own mother, they will arise from the depth of her unconscious and seek gratification through her own child, however well-educated she may be. The child feels this clearly, and very soon foregoes the expression of his own distress. Later, when these feelings of being deserted begin to emerge in the therapy of the adult, they are accompanied by intense pain and despair. It is clear that these people could not have survived so much pain as children. That would have been possible only in an empathic, attentive environment, which was lacking. Thus, all feelings had to be warded off. But to say that they were absent would be a denial of the empirical evidence. Several mechanisms can be recognized in the defense against early feelings of abandonment. In addition to simple denial, we usually find the exhausting struggle to fulfill the old, repressed, and by now often perverted needs with the help of symbols, cults, sexual perversions, groups of all kinds, alcohol, or drugs. Intellectualization is very commonly encountered as well, since it is a defense mechanism of great power. It can have disastrous results, however, when the mind ignores the vital messages of the body. See my reflections on Nietzsche's illness in The Untouched Key, 1990, and Breaking Down the Wall of Silence, 1991. All these defense mechanisms are accompanied by repression of the original situation and the emotions belonging to it. Accommodation to parental needs often, but not always, leads to the as-if personality. This person develops in such a way that he reveals only what is expected of him and fuses so completely with what he reveals that one could scarcely guess how much more there is to him behind this false self. He cannot develop and differentiate his true self because he is unable to live it. Understandably, this person will complain of a sense of emptiness, futility, or homelessness, for the emptiness is real. A process of emptying, impoverishment, and crippling of his potential actually took place. The integrity of the child was injured when all that was alive and spontaneous in him was cut off. In childhood, these patients have often had dreams in which they experienced themselves as at least partly dead. A young woman, Lisa, reported a recurrent dream. "My younger siblings are standing on a bridge and throw a box into the river. I know that I am lying in it dead, and yet I hear my heart beating. At this moment, I always wake." This dream combined her unconscious rage toward her younger siblings, for whom Lisa always had to be a loving, caring mother, with killing her own feelings, wishes, and demands. A young man, Bob, dreamed, "I see a green meadow on which there is a white coffin. I'm afraid that my mother is in it, but I open the lid, and luckily it is not my mother, but me." If Bob had been able, as a child, to express his disappointment with his mother, to experience his rage and anger, he could have stayed fully alive. But that would have led to the loss of his mother's love. And that, for a child, can mean the same as death. So he killed his anger, and with it a part of himself, in order to preserve the love of his mother. A young girl used to dream, "I am lying on my bed. I am dead. My parents are talking and looking at me, but they don't realize that I am dead." The difficulties inherent in experiencing and developing one's own emotions lead to mutual dependency, which prevents individuation. Both parties have an interest in bond permanence. The parents have found in their child's false self the confirmation they were looking for, a substitute for their own missing security. The child, who has been unable to build up his own sense of security, is first consciously and then unconsciously dependent on his parents. He cannot rely on his own emotions, has not come to experience them through trial and error, has no sense of his own real needs, and is alienated from himself to the highest degree. Under these circumstances, he cannot separate from his parents, and even as an adult, he is still dependent on affirmation from his partner, from groups, and especially from his own children. The legacy of the parents is yet another generation condemned to hide from the true self while operating unconsciously under the influence of repressed memories. Unless the heir casts off his inheritance by becoming fully conscious of his true past and thus of his true nature, loneliness in the parental home will necessarily be followed by an adulthood lived in emotional isolation. In search of the true self. How can therapy be of help here? It cannot give us back our lost childhood, nor can it change the past facts. No one can heal by maintaining or fostering illusion. The paradise of pre-ambivalent harmony, for which so many patients hope, is unattainable. But the experience of one's own truth and the post-ambivalent knowledge of it make it possible to return to one's own world of feelings at an adult level, without paradise, but with the ability to mourn. And this ability does, indeed, give us back our vitality. It is one of the turning points in therapy when the patient comes to the emotional insight that all the love she has captured with so much effort and self-denial was not meant for her as she really was, that the admiration for her beauty and achievements was aimed at this beauty and these achievements and not at the child herself. In therapy, the small and lonely child that is hidden behind her achievements wakes up and asks, "What would have happened if I had appeared before you sad, needy, angry, furious? Where would your love have been then? And I was all these things as well. Does this mean that it was not really me you loved, but only what I pretended to be? The well-behaved, reliable, empathic, understanding, and convenient child, who in fact was never a child at all? What became of my childhood? Have I not been cheated out of it? I can never return to it. I can never make up for it. From the beginning, I have been a little adult. My abilities, were they simply misused?" These questions are accompanied by much grief and pain, but the result is always a new authority that is establishing itself in the patient, a new empathy with her own fate, born out of mourning. Now the patient does not make light of manifestations of herself anymore, does not so often laugh or jeer at them, even if she still unconsciously passes them over or ignores them, in the same subtle way that her parents dealt with the child before she had any words to express her needs. Even as an older child, she was not allowed to say, or even to think, "I can be sad or happy whenever anything makes me sad or happy. I don't have to look cheerful for someone else, and I don't have to suppress my distress or anxiety to fit other people's needs. I can be angry, and no one will die or get a headache because of it. I can rage when you hurt me without losing you." In the majority of cases, it is a great relief to a patient to see that she can now recognize and take seriously the things she used to choke off, even if the old patterns come back again and again over a long period. But now she begins to understand that this strategy was her only chance to survive. Now she can realize how she still sometimes tries to persuade herself, when she is scared, that she is not. How she belittles her feelings to protect herself, and either does not become aware of them at all, or does so only several days after they have already passed. Gradually, she realizes how she is forced to look for distraction when she is moved, upset, or sad. When a 6-year-old's mother died, his aunt told him, "You must be brave. Don't cry. Now go to your room and play nicely." Once the therapeutic process has started, it will continue if it is not interrupted by interpretations or other types of intellectual defense. The suffering person begins to be articulate and breaks with her former compliant attitudes but because of her early experience, she cannot believe she is not incurring mortal danger. She fears rejection and punishment when she defends her rights in the present. The patient is surprised by feelings she would rather not have recognized, but now it is too late. Awareness of her own impulses has already been aroused, and there is no going back. Now the once intimidated and silenced child can experience herself in a way she had never before thought possible, and afterward she can enjoy the relief of having taken the risk and been true to herself. Whereas she had always despised miserliness, she suddenly catches herself counting up the 2 minutes lost to her session through a telephone call. Whereas she had previously never made demands herself and had always been tireless in fulfilling the demands of others, now she is suddenly furious that her therapist is again going on vacation. Or she is annoyed to see other people waiting outside the consulting room. What can this be? Surely not jealousy. That is an emotion she does not know. And yet, what are they doing here? Do others besides me come here? She hadn't realized that before. At first, it will be mortifying to see that she is not always good, understanding, tolerant, controlled, and above all, without needs, for these have been the basis of her self-respect. There is a big difference between having ambivalent feelings towards someone as an adult and suddenly experiencing oneself as a 2-year-old being fed by the maid in the kitchen and thinking in despair, why does Mom go out every evening? Why does she not take pleasure in me? What is wrong with me that she prefers to go to other people? What can I do to make her stay home? Just don't cry. Just don't cry. Peter, as a 2-year-old child, could not have thought in these words, but in the therapeutic session where he experienced this reality, he was both an adult and a toddler, and could cry bitterly. It was not a cathartic crying, but rather the integration of his earlier longing for his mother, which until now he had always denied. In the following weeks, Peter went through all the torments of his ambivalence toward his mother, who was a successful pediatrician. Her previously frozen, idealized portrait melted into the picture of a woman who had not been able to give her child any continuity in their relationship. I hated those beasts who were constantly sick and always taking you away from me. I hated you because you preferred being with them to being with me. Feelings of helplessness were mingled with long-dammed-up rage against the mother who had not been available to him when he needed her the most. As a result of becoming aware of these feelings, Peter could rid himself of a symptom that had tormented him for a long time. Its point was now easy to understand. His relationships to women changed as his compulsion, first to conquer and then to desert them, disappeared. Peter experienced his early feelings of helplessness, of anger, and of being at the mercy of his mostly absent mother in a manner that he could not previously have remembered. One can only remember what has been consciously experienced. But the emotional world of a tormented child is itself the result of a selective process that has eliminated the most important elements. These early feelings, joined with the pain of being unable to understand what is going on, which is part of the earliest period of childhood, are consciously experienced for the first time during therapy. It is like a miracle each time to see how much authenticity and integrity have survived behind dissimulation, denial, and self-alienation, and how they can reappear as soon as the patient finds access to the feelings. Nevertheless, it would be wrong to imply that there is a fully developed true self consciously hidden behind the false self. The important point is that the child does not know what he is hiding. Carl, age 42, expressed this in the following way. I lived in a glass house into which my mother could look at any time. In a glass house, however, you cannot conceal anything without giving yourself away, except by hiding it under the ground. And then, you cannot see it yourself either. An adult can be fully aware of his feelings only if he had caring parents or caregivers. People who were abused and neglected in childhood are missing this capacity and are therefore never overtaken by unexpected emotions. They will admit only those feelings that are accepted and approved by their inner censor, who is their parent's heir. Depression and a sense of inner emptiness are the price they must pay for this control. The true self cannot communicate because it has remained unconscious and therefore undeveloped in its inner prison. The company of prison warders does not encourage lively development. It is only after it is liberated that the self begins to be articulate, to grow, and to develop its creativity. Where there had been only fearful emptiness, or equally frightening, grandiose fantasies, an unexpected wealth of vitality is now discovered. This is not a homecoming, since this home has never before existed. It is the creation of home. The therapist's history. It is often said that psychotherapists suffer from an emotional disturbance. My purpose so far has been to clarify the extent to which this assertion can be shown to have a basis in experience. The therapist's sensibility, empathy, responsiveness, and powerful antennae indicate that as a child he probably used to fulfill other people's needs and to repress his own. Of course, there is the theoretical possibility that a sensitive child could have had parents who did not need to misuse him, parents who saw him as he really was, understood him, and tolerated and respected his feelings. Although such a child would develop a healthy sense of security, one could hardly expect that he would later take up the profession of psychotherapy, that he would cultivate and develop his sensitivity to others to the same extent as those whose parents used them to gratify their own needs, and that he would ever be able to understand sufficiently, without the basis of experience, what it means to have killed one's self. I think that our childhood fate can indeed enable us to practice psychotherapy, but only if we've been given the chance, through our own therapy, to live with the reality of our past and to give up the most flagrant of our illusions. This means tolerating the knowledge that to avoid losing the love of our parents, we were compelled to gratify their unconscious needs at the cost of our own emotional development. It also means being able to experience the resentment and mourning aroused by our parents' failure to fulfill our primary needs. If we have never consciously lived through this despair and the resulting rage, and have therefore never been able to work through it, we will be in danger of transferring this situation, which then would remain unconscious, onto our patients. It would not be surprising if our unconscious need should find no better way than to make use of a weaker person. Most readily available for exploitation are one's own children, or one's patients, who at times are as obedient and as dependent on their therapists as children are on their parents. A patient with antennae for his therapist's unconscious will react promptly. If he senses that it is important to his therapist to have patients who soon become autonomous and behave with self-confidence, he will quickly feel himself autonomous and react accordingly. He can do that. He can do anything that is expected of him. But because this autonomy is not genuine, it soon ends in depression. True autonomy is preceded by the experience of being dependent. True liberation can be found only beyond the deep ambivalence of infantile dependence. When he presents material that fits the therapist's knowledge, concepts, and skills, and therefore also his expectations, the patient satisfies his therapist's wish for approval, echo, understanding, and for being taken seriously. In this way, the therapist exercises the same sort of unconscious manipulation as that to which he was exposed as a child. A child can never see through unconscious manipulation. It is like the air he breathes, He knows no other, and it appears to him to be the only breathable air. What happens if we don't recognize the harmful quality of this air, even in adulthood? We will pass this harm on to others, while pretending that we are acting only for their own good. The more insight I gain into the unconscious manipulation of children by their parents, the more urgent it seems to me that we resolve our repression. Not only as parents, but also as therapists, we must be willing to face our history. Only after painfully experiencing and accepting our own truth can we be free from the hope that we might still find an understanding, empathic parent, perhaps in a patient, who will be at our disposal. This temptation to seek a parent among our patients should not be underestimated. Our own parents seldom or never listen to us with such rapt attention as our patients usually do, and they never revealed their inner world to us as clearly and honestly as do our patients at times. Only the never-ending work of mourning can help us from lapsing into the illusion that we have found the parent we once urgently needed, empathic and open, understanding and understandable, honest and available, helpful and loving, feeling, transparent, clear, without unintelligible contradictions. Such a parent was never ours, for a mother can react empathically only to the extent that she has become free of her own childhood. When she denies the vicissitudes of her early life, she wears invisible chains. Children who are intelligent, alert, attentive, sensitive, and completely attuned to the mother's well-being are entirely at her disposal. Transparent, clear, and reliable, they are easy to manipulate as long as their true self, their emotional world, remains in the cellar of the glass house in which they have to live, sometimes until puberty or until they come to therapy, and very often until they have become parents themselves. Robert, now 31, could never be sad or cry as a child without being aware that he was making his beloved mother unhappy and very unsure of herself. The extremely sensitive child felt himself warded off by his mother, who had been in a concentration camp as a child but had never spoken about it. Not until her son was grown up and could ask her questions did she tell him that she had been one of 80 children who had had to watch their parents going into the gas chambers and that not one child had cried. Because cheerfulness was the trait that had saved her life in childhood, her own children's tears threatened her equilibrium. Throughout his childhood, this son had tried to be cheerful. He could express glimpses of his true self and his feelings only in obsessive perversions, which seemed alien, shameful, and incomprehensible to him until he began to grasp their real meaning. One is totally defenseless against this sort of manipulation in childhood. The tragedy is that the parents, too, have no defense against it, as long as they refuse to face their own history. If the repression stays unresolved, the parents' childhood tragedy is unconsciously continued on in their children. Another example may illustrate this more clearly. A father who, as a child, had often been frightened by the anxiety attacks of his periodically schizophrenic mother, and was never given an explanation, enjoyed telling his beloved small daughter gruesome stories. He always laughed at her fears, and afterward comforted her with the words, "But it is only a made-up story. You don't need to be scared. You are here with me." In this way, he could manipulate his child's fear and have the feeling of being strong. His conscious wish was to give the child something valuable of which he himself had been deprived, namely protection, comfort, and explanations. But what he unconsciously handed on was his own childhood fear, the expectation of disaster, and the unanswered question, also from his childhood, "Why does this person I love frighten me so much?" Probably everybody has a more or less concealed inner chamber that she hides even from herself, and in which the props of her childhood drama are to be found. Those who will be most affected by the contents of this hidden chamber are her children. When the mother was a child, she hardly had a chance to understand what happened. She could only develop symptoms. As an adult in therapy, however, she can resolve these symptoms if she allows herself to feel what they were able to disguise. Feelings of horror, indignation, despair, and helpless rage. Can it be an accident that Heinrich Pestalozzi, who was fatherless from his 6th year onward and emotionally neglected despite the presence of his mother and of a nurse, neglected his only son, although he was capable, on the other hand, of giving orphan children genuine warmth and fatherliness? This son was finally considered to be mentally defective, although he had been an intelligent child. He died at the age of 30. Both his life and his death caused Pestalozzi much pain and guilt. In H. Gans, 1966, we can read, "On the occasion of his father's name day, the 5-year-old Jakobli, who could not write, gaily dictated to his mother, 'I wish, my dear papa, that you should see a lot more, and I thank you 100,000 times for your goodness, that you have brought me up so joyfully and lovingly. Now I shall speak from my heart. It makes me terribly happy if you can say, I have brought my son up to happiness. I am his joy and his happiness. Then shall I first give thanks for what you have done in my life.'" It was also Pestalozzi who is reputed to have said, "You can drive the devil out of your garden, but you will find him again in the garden of your son." The Golden Brain. Alphonse Daudet's Lettre de Mon Moulin includes a story that may sound rather bizarre, but nevertheless has much in common with what I have presented here. I shall summarize the story briefly. Once upon a time, there was a child who had a golden brain. His parents only discovered this by chance when he injured his head, and gold instead of blood flowed out. They then began to look after him carefully, and would not let him play with other children for fear of being robbed. When the boy was grown up and wanted to go out into the world, his mother said, "We have done so much for you, we ought to be able to share your wealth." Then her son took a large piece of gold out of his brain and gave it to his mother. He lived in great style with a friend, who, however, robbed him one night and ran away. After that, the man resolved to guard his secret and to go out to work, because his reserves were visibly dwindling. One day he fell in love with a beautiful girl who loved him, too, but no more than the beautiful clothes he gave her so lavishly. He married her and was very happy, but after 2 years she died, and he spent the rest of his wealth on her funeral, which had to be splendid. Once, as he was creeping through the streets, weak, poor, and unhappy, he saw a beautiful little pair of boots that would have been perfect for his wife. He forgot that she was dead, perhaps because his emptied brain no longer worked, and entered the shop to buy the boots. But in that very moment, he fell, and the shopkeeper saw a dead man lying on the ground. Daudet, who was to die from an illness of the spinal cord, wrote, following this story, "This story sounds as though it were invented, but it is true from beginning to end. There are people who have to pay for the smallest things in life with their very substance and their spinal cord. That is a constantly recurring pain. And then, when they are tired of suffering, does not mother love belong to the smallest but also indispensable things in life, for which many people paradoxically have to pay by giving up their living selves?" 2. Depression and grandiosity, two related forms of denial. The vicissitudes of the child's needs. Every child has a legitimate need to be noticed, understood, taken seriously, and respected by his mother. In the first weeks and months of life, he needs to have the mother at his disposal, must be able to avail himself of her and be mirrored by her. This is beautifully illustrated in one of Donald Winnicott's images. The mother gazes at the baby in her arms, and the baby gazes at his mother's face and finds himself therein. Provided that the mother is really looking at the unique, small, helpless being, and not projecting her own expectations, fears, and plans for the child. In that case, the child would find not himself in his mother's face, but rather the mother's own projections. This child would remain without a mirror, and for the rest of his life would be seeking this mirror in vain. Healthy development. If a child is lucky enough to grow up with a mirroring, available mother who is at the child's disposal, that is, a mother who allows herself to be made use of as a function of the child's development, then a healthy self-feeling can gradually develop in the growing child. Ideally, this mother should also provide the necessary emotional climate and understanding for the child's needs. But even a mother who is not especially warm-hearted can make this development possible, if only she refrains from preventing it and allows the child to acquire from other people what she herself lacks. Various studies have shown the incredible ability a child displays in making use of the smallest affective nourishment, stimulation, to be found in his surroundings. I understand a healthy self-feeling to mean the unquestioned certainty that the feelings and needs one experiences are a part of one's self. This certainty is not something one can gain upon reflection. It is there, like one's own pulse, which one does not notice as long as it functions normally. The automatic, natural contact with his own emotions and needs gives an individual strength and self-esteem. He may experience his feelings, sadness, despair, or the need for help, without fear of making the mother insecure. He can allow himself to be afraid when he is threatened, angry when his wishes are not fulfilled. He knows not only what he does not want, but also what he wants, and is able to express his wants, irrespective of whether he will be loved or hated for it. If a woman is to give her child what he will need throughout his life, it is absolutely fundamental that she not be separated from her newborn, for the hormones that foster and nourish her motherly instinct are released immediately after birth and continue in the following days and weeks as she grows more familiar with her baby. When a newborn is separated from his mother, which was the rule not so long ago in maternity hospitals and still occurs in the majority of cases out of ignorance and for the sake of convenience, then a great opportunity is missed for both mother and child. The bonding through skin and eye contact between mother and baby after birth stimulates in both of them the feeling that they belong together, a feeling of oneness that ideally has been growing from the time of conception. The infant is given the sense of safety he needs to trust his mother, and the mother receives the instinctive reassurance that will help her understand and answer her child's messages. This initial mutual intimacy can never again be created, and its absence can be a serious obstacle right from the start. The crucial significance of bonding has only recently been proved scientifically. One hopes that it will soon be taken into account in practice, not only in a few select maternity hospitals, but in larger hospitals as well, so that everyone will benefit from it. A woman who has experienced bonding with her child will be in less danger of mistreating him and will be in a better position to protect him from mistreatment by the father and other caregivers, such as teachers and babysitters. Even a woman whose own repressed history has been responsible for a lack of bonding with her child can later help him overcome this deficit if she comes to understand its significance. She will also be able to compensate for the consequences of a difficult birth if she does not minimize their importance and knows that a child who was heavily traumatized at the beginning of his life will be in particular need of care and attention in order to overcome the fears arising out of more recent experiences. The disturbance. What happens if a mother not only is unable to recognize and fulfill her child's needs, but is herself in need of assurance? Quite unconsciously, the mother then tries to assuage her own needs through her child. This does not rule out strong affection. The mother often loves her child passionately, but not in the way he needs to be loved. The reliability, continuity, and constancy that are so important for the child are therefore missing from this exploitative relationship. What is missing above all is the framework within which the child could experience his feelings and emotions. Instead, he develops something the mother needs. And although this certainly saves his life, by securing the mother's or the father's love at the time, it may nevertheless prevent him throughout his life from being himself. In such cases, the natural needs appropriate to the child's age cannot be integrated, so they are repressed or split off. This person will later live in the past without realizing it, and will continue to react to past dangers as if they were present. People who have asked for my assistance because of their depression have usually had to deal with a mother who was extremely insecure and who often suffered from depression herself. The child, most often an only child or the firstborn, was seen as the mother's possession. What the mother had once failed to find in her own mother, she was able to find in her child, someone at her disposal who could be used as an echo and could be controlled, who was completely centered on her, would never desert her, and offered her full attention and admiration. If the child's demands became too great, as those of her own mother once did, she was no longer so defenseless. She could refuse to allow herself to be tyrannized. She could bring the child up in such a way that he neither cried nor disturbed her. At last, she could make sure that she received consideration, care, and respect. Barbara, a mother of 4 children, at 35 had only scanty memories of her childhood relationship with her mother. At the beginning of treatment, she described her as an affectionate, warm-hearted woman who spoke to her openly about her own troubles at an early age, who was very concerned for her children, and who sacrificed herself for her family. She was often asked for advice by others within the sect to which the family belonged. Barbara reported that her mother had always been especially proud of her. The mother was now old and an invalid, and the patient was very concerned about her health. She often dreamed that something had happened to her mother and woke up with great anxiety. As a consequence of the emotions that arose in Barbara through therapy, this picture of her mother changed. Above all, when memories of toilet training entered her consciousness, she experienced her mother as demanding, controlling, manipulative, cold, petty, obsessive, easily offended, and hard to please. Many subsequent childhood memories of her mother confirmed these characteristics. Barbara was then able to connect with the real reasons for her long-suppressed anger and to discover what her mother was really like. She realized that when her mother had felt insecure in relation to her, she had in fact often been cold and had treated her badly. The mother's anxious concern for the child had served to ward off her aggression and envy. Since the mother had often been humiliated as a child, she needed to be valued by her daughter. Barbara experienced in therapy for the first time the agonizing fear and rage she had had to repress when she was 10 years old and came home from school on her mother's birthday to find her lying on the floor with closed eyes. The child cried out, thinking her mother was dead. The mother then opened her eyes and said, delighted, "You gave me the most precious birthday gift. Now I know that you love me, that somebody loves me." For decades, pity and compassion hindered Barbara from realizing the cruelty with which she had been treated. Triggered by later events, this memory could finally emerge, accompanied by feelings of rage and indignation. Gradually, the different pictures of the mother were united into that